The first case for argument this morning is Chapin v. Fort Broad Motors. Ms. Bauer?
Good morning. Trent Chapin prevailed on some of his claims in this case, but he also failed on some of his claims in this case. Nevertheless, the district court awarded Mr. Chapin every single penny of his attorney's fees that he sought in connection with this case. Awarding all of the attorney's fees when there was partial failure was an abuse of discretion, and we therefore ask that this court reduce the attorney's fee award significantly. Mr. Chapin presented two claims in this case, the first claim being a reverse discrimination claim, wherein he alleged that the Acura dealership had favoritism towards Pakistani Muslim employees and salespersons over white Christian employees like Mr. Chapin. There was also a retaliation claim against a related car dealership, a Toyota dealership, and Mr. Chapin lost his reverse discrimination claim. The jury decided against him on that claim. He prevailed on his retaliation claim. However, he did not obtain all of the relief that he sought in connection with his retaliation claim, which is a partial failure on that claim. He requested that the district court award him front pay on his retaliation claim. That claim was completely denied by the district court. Mr. Chapin also wanted back pay of approximately $160,000, trying to use different calculations as far as what his monthly wages and earnings were. And the district court used our position that you use the actual amount earned during that time frame. So where he wanted back pay of about $160,000, he was awarded by the district court approximately $55,000.
Well, he did win a compensatory damages judgment well in excess of the statutory maximum, as I understand it, plus $1 million in punitives, which is pretty stunning on this case.
Yes, that's correct. I would agree with the stunning comment. But again, when we're looking at the back pay that he wanted, which was all part of the total package of relief that he sought in this case, he did not get all the back pay that he sought, and he got none of the front pay that he sought. So he did not completely prevail 100% on his retaliation claim as far as the damages that were awarded and considered by the district court. And since there was not 100% success on the retaliation claim, we believe that there should be a substantial reduction in the fees that are awarded. I think if we look back to the Supreme Court Hensley case, which tells the district courts what they're supposed to do when there are claims on which a party does not prevail, you're supposed to exclude the time by the attorney on claims for which he did not prevail for his client. Judge Springman did not follow this rule because she awarded all of the fees sought by Mr. Chapin.
Well, I think she followed a corollary of the rule, which is that if the claims are really factually bound up with each other, then the full amount of the fees can be awarded if there's substantial success on one of them.
Correct.
Which is part of the rule.
Right. It is part of the rule if there's a common core set of facts, and certainly if you have a employee who alleges discrimination and then subsequently retaliation, there's some tie-in because you have to understand the first part to understand the second part of the case. But the discrimination claim that he was pursuing, other than the fact that it's the predicate for the retaliation claim, one claim does not have anything to do with the other claim. It just so happens that we had related car dealerships here.
Well, they have different elements, but they really are factually interdependent. You can't try the retaliation claim without the underlying factual basis for the discrimination claim.
You need the factual basis, but perhaps not. This was a four-day jury trial, and there's a substantial amount of time spent hearing testimony from witnesses related exclusively to the discrimination claim, which involves the conduct of Nadim Beg, who was the general manager at the car dealership who allegedly favored his fellow Pakistani Muslims.
So you think they could have just put... I mean, I'm having a hard time, too, trying to figure out where we draw the line, because you even said in order to understand the retaliation claim, you have to deal with the underlying facts. You have to deal with the discrimination. I mean, I don't see any – you're not giving us any guidance or any rule or anything I can grab hold of to see how you could separate them. you have.
I agree that it's a tough issue.
Therefore, the fees were appropriate.
I might agree with that proposition if it were a discrimination claim and then a retaliation claim all against one employer, where you need to understand the whole course of conduct, because a lot of times, I'm sure in your experience, you understand that discrimination claim, and then they file the charge of discrimination, and then subsequently there, not too shortly after, lose their job, so the retaliation claim comes along. But here we do have separate evidence, separate witnesses, separate standards. It just so happens that they're related car dealerships. And it is a difficult issue to address. I think if you go to this court's decision quite a few years ago in the Mary Beth G case, the court gives us some guidance on how you decide if claims are interrelated or not. That being what kind of remedy is being sought in the claim. And if the remedies are to address the different courses of conduct, then they're separate and distinct claims, although there may be some overlapping given the facts. And that's what we have here. Obviously, the standards that apply to a reverse discrimination claim are vastly different than the standards that apply to a retaliation claim. The general manager who was accused of retaliation, Larry Cruzy, he was not in any way involved in Mr. Chapin's employment with respect to his claim for the alleged discrimination. So again, we have different witnesses, different evidence, different standards. The district court just viewed this as one big continuum of a claim, which I think is the error that was committed. You can consider these to be separate and distinct claims, although, as the court has recognized, there is some interrelatedness, and you do need to know some of the factual basis. I suspect the jury could have just been advised that he had filed a claim of retaliation based upon alleged reverse discrimination without then hearing all the underlying evidence and witnesses that went with the discrimination claim. It might have been a way to perhaps structure some stipulation of facts with respect to the discrimination claim and then just start the testimony and the evidence at the trial with the retaliation claim, which would have resulted in a much shorter trial, much fewer witnesses, and concentration just on the retaliation claim. It's our suggestion that since there was a partial failure, he won one claim and lost the other and did not obtain all of the damages that he sought, that this court apply, as it's done in some other cases, a 50% reduction of the attorney's fees being sought or that were awarded to Mr. Chapin and his attorneys. I'm a sports fan, and it's kind of one of these, you win some and you lose some, which is what happened in this case with respect to the relief that was ultimately granted, but yet all of the attorney's fees were awarded. So there should be some basis for reducing the attorney's fees awarded to Mr. Chapin because he did not prevail on a discrimination claim, and he did not obtain front pay, and he did not obtain all of the back pay that he requested. The second issue I'd like to discuss with the court is the back pay issue itself. We raised a failure to mitigate damages defense in this case and had some post-trial motions on that, and the district court disagreed with us on failure to mitigate, which is contrary to the evidence that was presented from Mr. Chapin himself during the trial. Mr. Chapin admitted during the trial that once he no longer returned to the Toyota dealership, which was February 28th of 2005, whether you say he was terminated or it was a constructive discharge or our position was he just left and he never came back, he admitted during the trial that for 6 to 8 weeks thereafter, he didn't do anything to look for another job. That testimony was undisputed. In fact, it may have been as long as 6 months before he did have other employment. During that time, he just sat back and collected his unemployment. A failure to mitigate, as the court is aware, has two elements. The first being a failure to exercise reasonable diligence to find other employment. That prong is easily satisfied here based upon Mr. Chapin's own testimony that for 6 to 8 weeks he didn't do anything to look for another job. The second prong, and this is where the district court disagreed with us, that there was a reasonable likelihood that the employee would have found comparable employment. There's evidence in the record from Dan Schroeder, who's the controller for Toyota. He's been in the car business for well over 30 years, and he testified that there are always positions open for salespersons in the car business.
That's pretty generalized.
It is a very generalized statement, and I don't want to belittle Mr. Chapin's chosen occupation of being in the car business, but we are talking about the car business. We're not talking about, let's say, a bank president in today's economy and with the bank mergers who's lost a position, or a highly skilled technical person who may take some time to find new employment.
Right, but this is kind of a small community, isn't it? And considering that he had surreptitiously taped his boss, which was the gravamen of the retaliation claim, the conversation was on audio tape and sort of sealed the deal on the retaliation case, and that information spread throughout the car dealership community in this area. Nobody wanted to hire him.
Well, that was Mr. Chapin's allegation, is that everybody in the car community knew about the tape.
That's plausible.
He didn't present any witnesses from other car dealerships. He didn't present anyone who came in and said, well, yes, perhaps I would have thought about hiring him, but I heard that he taped his employer, and so I don't want an employee like that. It's just his own say-so that I couldn't get a job in the Fort Wayne car community because of the tape. There's no evidence in the record that anybody knew about the tape other than Mr. Chapin. In fact, our car dealership didn't know about it until well into the investigation by the EEOC. So during those 6 to 8 weeks when he admits he wasn't looking for a job, he didn't present any evidence that there was somebody out there willing to hire him but for the fact that he surreptitiously taped this conversation. And Fort Wayne has a lot of car dealerships, for better or for worse. So, you know, in the surrounding area, there's certainly a lot of those. And again, it's not the type of occupation where you might expect somebody to need to take a certain amount of time on their new job search because of the nature of the work that they do. It is the car business. And I think it's telling that when Mr. Chapin's unemployment compensation ran out, he quickly found other employment working for a car dealership again.
Out of town.
Correct. It was out of town.
Substantially out of town, right?
Yes, I can't remember exactly the state, but yes, it was substantially out of town. But again, it just goes to show that had he looked perhaps further than immediately in Fort Wayne, if you agree with your position or observation as far as the local community as kind of being a done deal, that he couldn't find another employment. He didn't get another job, and it wasn't a difficult thing for him to do. So
I'm interested in the factual basis for the compensatory damages award. Was really the only factual substantiation for that this list that the plaintiff drew up himself of the things
yes.
that he says he lost, although we don't know whether they were sold.
Correct.
Exactly what became of these.
I was just going to turn to the compensatory damages issue. There was that Exhibit 8, which is in the record and is in our appendix, which is his own notes as far as items of property which he claims he somehow lost or had to give up or had to sell because of his loss of employment. He admits that he really didn't have any, he doesn't have any documentation to back that up. And obviously the court's not here to assess credibility, but this is all on Mr. Chapin's say-so that these were items of damage that he suffered as a result of losing his employment. The only other issue being perhaps what the jury may have awarded him for emotional distress. And certainly in this kind of a situation, $100,000 or anything near that in compensatory damages for emotional distress is
problem.
Way out of the ballpark.
Right, and the problem is we don't know how much the jury allocated.
Yes, we never know.
Well, we could have if there had been an itemization by the
That's
jury,
correct.
Which is sometimes done. But nobody asked for that kind of a special verdict form, apparently.
I don't recall that we did, no. And I see my white light went off.
Barry, you've decided not to challenge the constructive discharge. I mean, you're not talking about the merits of the case this morning at all? I mean, I appreciate the argument you made so far, but...
Yes, no, we have lots of issues in this appeal, as you
can rely on the brief, that's
and
fine.
And I would rely on the brief to the extent Mr. Vangler talks about the constructive discharge claim in his presentation. I'll address that on rebuttal.
Fine. All right. Thank you. Mr. Vangler?
I I think I will change the order a little bit. I'll follow the brief because the court has indicated some interest perhaps in the issue of the actual discharge. And I think the evidence was uncontradicted that with respect to Mr. Chapin, he had a very simple choice. And Mr. Cruzy made it very clear, and that is either, quote, you get rid of the claim right away or you're not working here anymore. So he was put in a dilemma that's impossible for somebody to handle. That means, oh, give up all my federal civil rights, discharge the claim, then I'll come back.
Well, was the employment terminated on February 28th?
It was terminated when he didn't drop the claim. You're right.
I'm right. I'm asking the question.
Yeah.
Is your position that at the end of the 28th conversation, now, Chapin said he would withdraw it, right?
Yeah, he would withdraw, but the evidence...
I understand that. So, but his statement that he would withdraw it, for whatever reasons that, you know, he was induced or coerced, in your view, to do it, it's your position, once he said he would withdraw it, that he was effectively terminated that day.
That's right, because he was put in a position of no win. He could not... Mr. Cruzy already said, well, I could eliminate you for non-performance. Yet the evidence is uncontradicted. There was never any claim that he was warned about performance problems before that. And the evidence was also uncontradicted when Mr. Chapin tried to pick up his check. He asked them to mail a check. Oh, no. He had to come back. He had to face the wrath of Mr. Cruzy again. So this was a three-day lapse between when they found out that he had filed the charge and when they called him in the office. And they didn't just have Mr. Cruzy there. They had another gentleman there, and they had the manager of human resources. So they knew exactly what they were going to say to Mr. Chapin, and they told him, you either withdraw this charge or you don't have a job. And he said, I'll never work here again because of this kind of attitude, and therefore he knew he wasn't going to withdraw the charge, and therefore he knew he wasn't... all he wanted to do was get his check. That evidence was uncontradicted. And what goes on even further in this, to make it clear that there is the intentional actions by the Romanato group, is so they write the March 8th letter, which is at Appellate's Appendix 258, and say, Mr. Chapin, it's your misunderstanding that you don't have a job here. Your misunderstanding. No, it's very clear. You don't withdraw the charge. You don't have a job at all.
Well, that's skipping over a lot of course of conduct between the parties, between February 28th and March 8th, which consists of numerous phone calls and messages left unreturned, whereby Mr. Cruzy clarified that the client was...
supposedly still
employed.
Yeah, well, that's easy for Mr. Cruzy to say.
And that your client reported to work to pick up his check and said he was working on a painting project at home and would be back soon.
My problem is I don't think the record said he would return soon. I think he said he'd return Mr. Cruzy's call. Now, that's my remembrance of the summary of that evidence. But his evidence also was...
He said he understood that he... was wanted on the job and that he wanted to remain on the job
in that
conversation that occurred at the dealership when he came to pick up his commission check.
Okay, well, he also testified, as I pointed out in my brief, that he would have said anything to pick up his check. He needed his check. He told him he would never work. The evidence was uncontradicted that he would never work there again, given the attitude Mr. Cruzy had.
Right, but that's a choice on his part as opposed to a constructive discharge precipitated
My problem is I don't get to that point, and neither did the district court judge get to that point, because he was put on the position, and it was never raised again. If you notice, from February 28th on, there was never an indication by the representatives, Mr. Cruzy and the manager of human resources, that, by the way, we made a mistake. We really liked your performance. And you really do have a job here, and you don't have to withdraw the charge of discrimination. They never came back and said that to him. So his die was cast.
What species of constructive discharge is this claim?
I don't
it's
know.
It's obviously not an intolerable working condition,
no,
so it doesn't
this,
meet that standard.
Well, the district court addressed that issue and indicated that the jury could believe that given the course of conduct and all of a sudden this allegation of, well, we could discharge you for non-performance, when in fact they never raised that issue prior to February 28th of 2000.
I'm asking a legal question.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
How was the jury instructed?
You know, quite frankly, I don't recall.
That's kind of important.
I understand. But there were 33 instructions, and I got to be honest, I don't recall because I concentrated on this with respect to the fact that it was an actual discharge issue, and the district court did too.
Well, that claim has very weak evidentiary support. And as I understand this record, this is a constructive discharge claim or nothing. Because he was never actually fired.
Well, I think the district court indicated that the means and the effect
Look,
of it.
Look, we've got de novo review on
yeah.
this particular, so
okay.
what the district court believed is irrelevant.
Okay.
Okay?
Well,
I'm asking a legal question. What
yeah.
species of constructive discharge was this? It
well,
seems like you've conceded it's not an intolerable working conditions species of constructive discharge claim because his working conditions were not intolerable, and there's no evidentiary support for that.
Well,
so what kind of constructive discharge claim was it?
I think
it?
It's from the point of view that they set him up in a legal position that he couldn't win. And in that sense, it's an intolerable situation from that point of view.
It doesn't meet the standard for that kind of constructive discharge claim. Was the jury instructed on constructive discharge?
I believe they were, Your Honor.
But you just don't remember what the
I
legal
don't
standard
remember.
Was.
I don't remember what the standard was. Moving on to the issue of that was first raised by the Romanato group, and that is that the obviously the issue of attorney's fees will disappear if this court reverses the fact that Mr. Chapin was not terminated either actually or by constructive discharge. However, I think the court is well aware of the arguments in the brief that go back and forth with respect to the fact that this case had taken 3 years and the bulk of the work was done with respect to a 4-day trial and numerous post-trial motions filed by the Romanato group and that there were related legal theories involved in this case. So I don't think that it's going to require any kind of further analysis other than I wanted to address the one case that was brought up by opposing counsel, and that was the Mary Beth case. In that case, I believe, involved, I recall, the that was, I think it was four different litigants in that case, and if I have it correct, it was there was a determination that there was some reduction of attorney's fees allowed in that case, but it had to do mostly with respect to multiple issues in that case. That's a 1983 case. And the course of conduct in this case, as the court has correctly pointed out with respect to this case, it was an ongoing course of conduct. That case, the Mary Beth case, of course, it involved false arrests, excessive force, and a strip search analysis, and it was four different plaintiffs with at least, I believe, two different proceedings. involved. And as a result, I think that that is probably not something that's going to be weigh as heavily in the analysis as opposing counsel would like it to weigh.
Regarding the compensatory damages claim,
yes.
Is it correct that the sum total of the documentary support for that claim consists of this itemized list that your client wrote himself, apparently?
Documentary support, yes, Your Honor. And this is, you're focusing on the non-pecuniary damage, compensatory damage award. And that testimony was in the record. That exhibit was in the record. He told how he lost. He had to sell property to pay his bills.
He wasn't specific on which of these items were sold. And I mean, the testimony as I read it was extremely vague. He said, I sold some stuff. I gave away some stuff. I had to give up some stuff because I couldn't afford. I had to give up my African cat worth $10,000 and the breeding cages and toys for the cat, and because I couldn't keep it up anymore, so I just gave them away. And there was no further evidentiary support for that value. That's $10,000.
Well,
on his say-so, how is that not completely speculative?
Well, it's because it was his testimony that was unchallenged by the opposing party.
I think it was challenged as speculative.
Oh,
they didn't want this in. There was a vigorous fight over this exhibit and his testimony on every item on this list as being entirely based on speculation and an invitation to the jury to award money based on speculative dollar amounts.
But then again, since the emotional distress component is merged into this, and as the court correctly pointed out,
and that was a mistake too. That should have been separated out.
It could have been a 90-10. It could have been a 10-90. We don't know at this point in time. But I think there was more than sufficient evidence to justify the merger of those two and reach the $100,000 maximum. And then, of course, you have the analysis of I believe it was Judge Posner when he talked in the Lust case about really. If you get punitive damages, it doesn't make any difference. It's a $100,000 maximum anyway. So if the component's 10% compensatory and 90% punitive, it's a mathematical. It still sums up to $100,000. And that's how that was approached, Your Honor. I was trying to find my notes to try to, again, talk about the constructive discharge issue. And I don't believe I have it in front of me other than relying on the district court's analysis that's in the opinion that was originally done on the trial rule motion 50 analysis. And as the court may well understand from my position, is it seems very hard for an employee who is told that they either withdraw the charge of discrimination or they don't have a job, that they have to somehow withdraw their charge of discrimination and lose their federal rights to keep their job. So to get to the constructive discharge, you have to totally discredit the fact that this person, as a mandatory condition, had to withdraw the charge of discrimination, which is not the way employees ought to be forced into the box. And so I think the constructive discharge aspect should not be the tail wagging the dog in this, because if every case that came before this circuit said, oh, by the way, you were told to withdraw the charge of discrimination, you didn't have a job, and then the rule then becomes, okay, well, to win an actual discharge case, I guess you have to withdraw your charge of discrimination and go back to work and see what happens to you. Because I don't think that is the... If that sets the precedence for this, then there'll never be a charge of discrimination filed and kept.
That's sort of alarmist on this record.
Well,
within a very short time of the taped conversation, his boss is on the phone with him saying, look, you have a job here. We didn't mean it. He never withdrew the charge. He was not required to withdraw the charge. He was welcomed back. He was expected back. They wanted to know when he was coming back. There are multiple phone calls. He's not returning the messages. When he does come in for his check, he says he's working on a painting project at home. He really, will be back soon, wants to be back soon, wants to continue his employment with this dealership. So you're excluding all of the evidence which makes your interpretation of that one taped telephone conversation somewhat implausible as a basis for a constructive discharge, setting aside the issue of I don't really know what kind of theory of constructive discharge you're advancing because you're not recalling how the jury was instructed.
I understand, but we don't have to get there. As you well know, that's Mr. Chapin's position. Because if all of a sudden every employer can say, okay, Mr. Employee or Mrs. Employee, he didn't even know whether he knew apparently withdrew the charge discrimination, but he knew one thing, Mr. Cruzy knew one thing is that at that point in time, after he told him, you withdraw that charge or don't come back, you don't have a job, at that point in time, with manager of HR there and with another gentleman there from the dealership, you put yourself in a position that basically vitiates a person's right to keep a charge of discrimination on file. And that at that point in time, the die is cast with respect to the employer. I don't see how you can call back 4 days later or 6 days later and go, oh, he never said, forget the charge of discrimination. He kept saying, it's your misunderstanding. Why would it be Mr. Chapin's misunderstanding? It's very clear in the record. You don't withdraw the charge, you don't have a job. There's no misunderstanding in that. And I thank you.
Can I just ask you a small question? How were the defendants referred to at trial?
One was Fort Roar.
And the other was Mid-States?
Pardon?
And the other was
Mid-States.
And that's how the jury heard the description, the name,
yeah.
The thing. Why did you choose, and I suspect I'll ask Ms. Bauer, to label this Toyota? Is that because there are less letters in that than Fort Roar? And why was it chosen to Acura?
Because those were the...
Are they the defendants, the Toyota Motor Company?
No, but those are the automobile
models. Well, they sell other cars, too. You could have said used cars, too, I suppose,
as Acura, Subaru, and Toyota,
yeah,
and
but
Kia.
Why was Fort Roar not sufficient for identifying it in the brief as a defendant in Mid-States? The shorthand usually is to aid the court and of course, the writer. That was the only reason that just the Toyota would jump out at us more and Acura would jump out at us more rather than the lesser-known Fort Roar and Mid-States? Those are major. Toyota and Acura, I guess, is Honda, is it not? Those are major corporations.
Yeah.
So it was an attempt to have us more easily identify what? I mean, I just find that why we are having in the briefs Toyota, the name of a particular brand that's sold by the defendant.
I can tell you why I did it.
I asked you at trial that you didn't do it, apparently. You said to me the defendants were mentioned at trial. I mean, I haven't read the record.
Yeah.
So was Toyota and Acura mentioned at the trial, I guess I'm asking?
They were mentioned, but also was Fort Roar and Mid-States. It depended on who was testifying and how that was done. You would see in some of my appendix, you would see that it would say Mid-States and Fort Roar. As far as this appellate brief goes, I was just following the appellant's language so that we would stay consistent there.
I see. Well,
it leads to less confusion.
I see. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Bauer?
To answer your last question, I think it was just a matter of less syllables if we're saying Toyota rather than Fort Roar Motors. I hope we didn't create any undue confusion to the court on how we labeled.
Well, it wasn't a confusion to me. I just found it a little unusual, and I just wondered how it was presented if the actual defendants are two corporations, Fort Roar and Mid-States, the fact that they may have a used Pontiac on the lot. I suppose you could have said Pontiac or Jeep, is even if they had that, Jeep would have been shorter than Toyota or Acura. So I just find it as a stylistic point, an interesting one to.
And during trial, they were referred to, all four of those were used, kind of interspersed. The question arose as far as how the jury was instructed. There were instructions on constructive discharge given to the district court, which we obviously objected to. I don't have the instructions in front of me, but I believe Judge Springman used a, I think there is a Seventh Circuit pattern instruction for constructive discharge cases, so that probably would have been the instruction she would have used.
There is an alternative theory of constructive discharge that is applicable here about or applicable to situations where the employer communicates that the termination is forthcoming, and under those circumstances the employee doesn't have to wait for the termination to come but can resign and claim constructive discharges. Is that the sort of instruction that went to the jury on this case?
I don't believe there was an instruction such as that. It was more of the intolerable working condition type of instruction that went to the jury, which is why we objected to that instruction going forward, because, as you indicated, that is not this type of a case. Mr. Chapin.
So I understand you, like Mr. Vegler, are not sure of whether that was submitted to the jury. I mean, we'll obviously examine the record, but
there were instructions on constructive discharge, and it's my recollection that it was in the context of the intolerable working condition situation. And the whole issue of this being constructive discharge is something that we raised while the trial was going on, because that's the first we heard of constructive discharge is when we were talking about jury instructions and we're having conferences about that, and they were submitted shortly before trial. So this whole intolerable work condition issue came up kind of late in the game. But again, Mr. Chapin, he wasn't forced into a box. He made his own box. We have two tapes, and obviously the first one, I wished, from February 28th, didn't exist, because obviously my general manager, Larry Cruzy, was irate and screaming, and he sounds horrible if you listen to that tape. But he never told Mr. Chapin that he was fired. Then the plaintiff, Mr. Chapin, and his attorney want us to look at that one tape just in a vacuum and not look at the follow-up communications and the telephone calls. And the second tape, which is on, which is in our supplemental appendix, page 254, and the discussion that went on between Mr. Cruzy and Mr. Chapin, page 254 of our appendix, Mr. Cruzy, so my question is, do you want to work here? Mr. Chapin, I do. I need a little time off. And they discussed the painting job. And then further on, Mr. Cruzy, will you call me back? Mr. Chapin, I'll call you. I will call you. Mr. Cruzy, I want you to work here. Mr. Chapin, I do too. And he just never came back to work. And after this second recorded conversation, there were again letters and additional follow-up phone calls. Hey, we want you to work here. Come back to work. So this is not a constructive discharge type of a situation. It's certainly not intolerable working condition, which is a very difficult standard, as this court is aware, for any plaintiff to satisfy. And I see my lights on, so I think my time's up. Thank you.
Ms. Bauer, thank you, Mr. Wagner. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the second case.